All right, everybody. Welcome to our study of yesterday and today and forever, the mystery of Hebrews. And I want to think with us tonight in our class about one of the unexpected mysteries of this great book, and that's what in the world we are. I want you to think for a minute about the different kinds of answers that are given to what is a man? What is man? Depending on which kind of a worldview we hold. Our worldview is one in which we think this is the universe and then God is involved in this. God who exists outside of it is involved in it, and we live in the world of physical material things, but we also are spiritual and moral creatures or beings who relate to God. If you have a worldview which is closed, within which nothing exists but what you can see and sense, then what does a human being become in that situation? If you have one in which there is a world here, a universe here, and then there's a God out here somewhere, and He's not involved in this universe, then what's man in that situation? I'd like to read a passage where I freely admit that what we're going to talk about tonight is not the main argument, but I believe it is the assumption that undergirds this whole discussion. And I hope on Sunday morning in the class, Lord willing, to read this same passage and then to trace the argument that is made through this passage a little more carefully. It's a passage about the work of Jesus, but what it assumes is the human condition. Remember that when the end of chapter 1 occurred, it was talking about angels. Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to provide service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? I think verse 5 of chapter 2 actually picks up with that same idea. So here's the reading, the rest of chapter 2 here. For He did not subject to angels the world to come about which we are speaking. But someone has testified somewhere saying, what is man that you think of him, or a son of man that you are concerned about him? You've made him a little lower, or for a little while lower than angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You have put everything in subjection under his feet. For in subjecting all things to him, He left nothing that is not subject to Him. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to Him. But we do see Him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of His suffering death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God He might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for Him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the originator of their salvation through sufferings. For both He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one. For this reason He's not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brothers. In the midst of the assembly, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children whom God has given me. Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, so that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. For clearly, he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendants of Abraham. Therefore, In all things he had to be made like his brothers, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. That is a passage in which there is so much good news, but one great question. And that question is a quote, actually, from Psalm 8. It's in verse 6, I believe, there. What is man? And, of course, it's talking about mankind. It's talking about human beings, or all of us are included in the question. Suppose you do leave out the mystery of the world view that we've been noticing when we talked about a son who is yesterday and today and forever, the timelessness there, and a God who spoke. That is, a God who involved himself in history and who made himself known. And then a world where there are angels who can be sent to as his messengers to accomplish his purposes for his people. And in the world where the Son of God has made God known and has made purification for sins and now has inherited a more excellent name than any angel. So leave that out, and what are some of the answers you get to that question? Made in his image. All right, we've got to leave that out for a minute. Leave that out, and what are some of the answers the world gives us to the question of what is man? We're struggling with this in our society all over the place. There are all kinds of arguments that go on because we have conflicting assumptions about that question. What are some of the answers you get about it? One is that we're expendable, somebody said. One of them is we just are, there's a reason why they would say we're expendable, I think, Gene. Okay, what you were going to say? What would be the reason why it would be suggested that we're expendable? All right, so Brendan said, because we're just like the animals. We are biological creatures who exist for a certain period of time, whatever we might be allowed in the world of fate to live, and that's it. That's one answer that a lot of people assume. Can you give me another answer? We get to the question. We've said one, we're an expendable creature. What else? Todd?
We're able to do something. We're able to do stuff. We're able to do wonderful things, but we're able to do terrible.
All right. So Todd says that another answer we get is man is a powerful or a creature who has a lot of ability for good or bad. And of course the problem is you leave out the worldview that we take, then who knows the difference between what those two things are, good or bad? Ron?
They're also saying that we were made by a superior being outside of this world, but not God.
All right, so maybe we're the work of some accidental connections of some being's work, but he's not the God of the Bible. That's one thing. Can you think of other things? Nobody has said some of the answers. We are simply creatures who, biological organisms who have evolved and still are. That's one answer we get. Another answer we get is that we are autonomous organisms within ourselves. We are whatever we want to think we are. We're whatever we feel like we are. And that can change, Casey. All right, that we're just accidental and therefore meaningless creatures. That's another. Some of it, we are social creatures. Some of it, we, another would be we are wards of the state. We're to be, we're functionaries for the mass of humanity in that way. Another idea would be that this is a stunning thing, but that we are not. I know it makes your head spin, but in the world of philosophy, the nihilistic idea would be that would be very much the possibility. It would be one reason why we have suicide is such a high-ranking cause of death in our world. Now, there are assumptions undergirding Hebrews 2 that are so helpful in understanding the way the spiritual outlook on the human condition and what it would be. Now, I'd like you to be aware that there are many who think this whole passage is only talking about Jesus, that he's the one that Psalm 8 would be ultimately talking about, and I do agree that he's the fulfillment of this. But please notice that in verse 9, where it contrasts the statements that are made, I think, about man and at the end of verse 8 with what we do see in Jesus. So the idea would be it's been talking about how Jesus, how things are said of him that are not said of any angel. So the argument would be, all right, so now in verse 5 of chapter 2, it skips to one of the problems. So if the angels were the ones through whom God made the law known to us, if they were the ones as he said chapter 2 and verse 2, if the word was spoken through angels, then that would suggest that the angels are somehow intermediate between God and man. So if Jesus became man, wouldn't that mean he's lesser than an angel? And then if Jesus suffered death, wouldn't that not mean that he's less than the powerful man even? How could he be said to be greater than an angel? And that's a part of the argument here. But in making the point, what the writer is going to do is to say that Jesus is an example of the true man, that he's the way God restores man to his intended calling and position, that he's the way God puts us back how we were meant to be. And in the process of that, there are several statements that I think might be good ways for us to think about who we are. And it starts with the idea in verse 8 that God has put everything under his feet. Now, when in biblical history would that idea be found of man? All right. And what about Adam? All right, first man, that's true, but he named the animal, but when God said, let us make man after our image, which he did, and then what did he give to man? What was his gift to man? Dominion, that's right. That's the idea. So the idea of being the agent of God's moral and spiritual government of his universe, of the things that he made, of having the privilege and the intelligence and the ability to be a steward of God's creation, to make use of it for what purpose? For God's glory and our joy. That was the situation. And the Hebrew writer is making the point here that in doing that, there is cause both for man's great dignity and also reason to think about man's insignificance. Let me say it that way. It looks like those two things could not possibly go together. And yet, If you notice where these quotes come from in verses 5 through 7, 5 through 8, it's the 8th Psalm. And in that Psalm, it's like you have somebody out here in the field, a man like you or a woman like you, and looking up at the stars of the universe and being in awe of the great power and the wonder of all of it, and thinking to himself, What are we? What am I? Out of all of this, that you would be mindful of me and come to my aid, and that you would visit me and care about me. Did you ever sleep outside it when you were a kid, or look it up at that? David?
You've ever been to the ocean?
All right. All right, you see the ocean and the waves, the sound of that. I agree, that's almost a spiritual situation. I want you to notice the other side of this. Look at Psalm 144 for a second. And I've called this course the mystery of Hebrews for a reason. But these things often are coins with two sides. Psalm 144 is like the same reasoning of Psalm 8, but it follows it down a different path. Look at verse 3 of Psalm 144. Lord, what is man that you look after him, or a son of man that you think of him? Man's like a breath. His days are like a passing shadow. Then it talks about what happens in God's heavens with the mountains, the smoke, the lightning, and so forth. Can you see that he's saying that all of this makes me so insignificant when I realize I could be standing here but not able to draw my next breath, and God still would care about me, right? Now, if everything has been put under man's feet, and if we can gather here tonight and sing, "This is my Father's world," why does one of our elders have to get up and ask us to pray for people who've been devastated by a hurricane today? If everything is put under man's feet, why isn't everything under man's feet? Isn't that a mystery to you? Doesn't that make you wonder a little bit? Now, I know you have, as Christians, you have some answers for this, but look at what it said in verse 8 there. "For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him." But what does it say? All right, at present, right now, not every... Now, I know this is true in another way with Jesus, but right now for us, not everything is. Right? So, however powerful we are, as Todd mentioned a while ago, and however imaginative and creative and skillful and capable and all of that, there are still things we are not in control of. Name some of them for me. All right, the weather would be an obvious illustration today. That'd be one. A day like this here, we'd like to claim credit for it, but we're not. So what are some other things that we're not in control of? Terry? Life. All right. Obviously, guys like Aaron can help us do well and help us through a lot of things, but there's a limit to it, isn't there? And there are a lot of things that happen in life that remind us that we're still like the fellow in Psalm 144 and verse 3 who said, "What is man that you're mindful of him?" What else is something that we're not, that's not in subjection to us right now?
Our health.
Even our own personal health. Well, there are some times when we can't fix things either for ourselves. We can do some things, but we're still mortal. What else? What? Other people's choices. Sometimes, or is this just me? My own choices. Have you not done anything recently where you made a choice and then you, a week or so later, you're thinking, or maybe 30 minutes later, you're thinking, "What was I thinking?" And you realize you, well, that's the problem. You were thinking. That's it. What else? All right, the limits of life. Death is one of the most obvious. We'll talk more about that in a second here. I think about, I'd like you just to think about some of the societal problems that we try to address and try to deal with, and just to use some obvious current ones. What about the racial animus, for example, that exists in our country? Have we been spending money and working on that and dealing with that and trying to address it? How long? How we doing? I think my own judgment is we're better than we used to be at it, but it doesn't appear to me like we have fixed it. Does it to you? I think when it comes to even people's attitudes toward each other, it takes something outside of our ability to do that. And in terms of the world itself, the natural world around us, think of how much of this, how much of the talk right now is one way or another, like climate change, that type of thing, you know, the discussion that goes on and the money that gets spent about that and all of that. And you wonder, are we really in control? Are we going to be able to control stuff like that? I have my doubts about it personally. I don't mean as a political, I mean as a spiritual principle more than a political one. But that's reality for us, and it just seems like this part of the Christian worldview is not shared by the broader culture in a lot of ways. Do you see it differently than that? I think there is the assumption either we can do anything or we can do nothing. Whatever will be, will be. Fate is fate. And the idea of a God who gets involved in it and comes to our aid and helps us and changes it, that's a uniquely Christian viewpoint. You realize that? That is a blessing that we have to offer to the world, that the world needs. All right. Now, okay, any other comment down to here? Okay, so we need to think about then why there is the difference between this and this. And here's the way this develops. So in Hebrews 2, it seems to me like it teaches that all of us are subject to tempting, temptation, or testing. Actually, the same word in the original. But what I'm getting at here is is really down at the end of this passage. He himself is tempted, was tempted in that which he has suffered. So as a moral and spiritual creature, given a certain amount of freedom to exercise will and be responsible for it, man is also subject to temptation or testing. What was the first temptation? All right. It was before that, you shall not surely die. Actually, the first temptation is, yes, has God really said? Remember that? And then once doubt is created, then it is direct contrary. You will not surely die. And then the reasoning. God knows that if you do this, your eyes will be open and you'll be as gods. You can run your own world. You can know good and evil. You can define it for yourself. You can have everything. All right, that's temptation. Testing is the form of temptation which allows moral uprightness to develop and which allows us to show or to grow and which allows us to exercise wisdom and strength. It's the opportunity to be loyal to God. There are two different impacts of the same sorts of experience often. All right, so when temptation or testing happens to us, who is behind it? Who does it to us? This is the Christian worldview now, David. All right, the devil does. This passage will tell us down in verse 14, the end of verse 14, who really is the one who's responsible for this. God may allow us to be tested, but he does not tempt us to do wrong. He doesn't tempt people to do evil. He himself can't be tempted to do evil. The devil, on the other hand, is a liar. Does not love. He's not trying to help anybody. He's a murderer. And therefore, what is the outcome of failure where temptation is concerned? All right, there's the word for what happens. We can sin. In fact, I'll say it differently. Man, this would be the right way to say it, has sinned. What does that to sin mean? Has sinned. All right, he sinned against God. In other words, he made himself as God, and he therefore missed the mark for which he was made. So if we sin, if everything is put under our feet, but we sin, then we miss the mark of our calling, right? That's the idea. So man has sinned and fallen short of God's glory, and all of us have. And even before we are accountable ourselves, we still have been born into a world which has been impacted by sin. All right, so go back to the beginning. What was the natural world impacted any by the sin of the man and the woman? I mean, ultimately, was the natural world impacted any by the sin of the man and the woman? When they heard the voice of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they were afraid and they hid themselves, and then in the outcome of that, how was the natural world impacted? Larry? Yeah, one of them is our dying, right? Death enters the picture, Larry. All right, he created us to live forever. That ruins creation by definition, doesn't it? When we don't, Brendan? All right, the animals paid the price, and he He skinned some of them in order to cover the man and the woman. That's right. Something else happened. Dustin? All right. And what happened when they worked the land? All right. Brought forth thistles. Man had to work by the sweat of his brow. It wasn't work. It's that the frustration and the difficulty of all of that. How many of those things have impacted your journey right now? Just the frustration of things not working like they ought to work. All of us, right? So if I write up here that suffering enters the picture in that way, in that reality, in this text, if you'll notice, starting in verse 9, suffering gets mentioned over and over again. It gets mentioned of Jesus there. Then in verse 11, then it goes on down. It certainly comes up again. In verse 18, it's a prominent theme in this passage. But if I could add to it the concept of frustration, I think that would place it within the, not only within our personal experience, but also within the world where we live. And this is an essential element in Christian understanding of the world where we live and what man is. Because the questions are, all right, so why do the innocent suffer? Why does a little child get sick? Why do bad accidents happen and good people are the ones who pay the price? And what's the Christian answer to that? If there is one, there are questions I don't know the answers to, but if there is one, where is it in this? Because things are not like God meant for them to be. We're born into a world where wrong has gotten a foothold, people and the world have been impacted, and all of us live in that situation. So it's not, you know, the people would treat that, well, if you guys believe in a God and you worship and serve that God and you think He's ruling, look what He has done to people. Have you run across anybody with that objection? Brian, you have. I have. Certainly, Phil, you have. And the answer to that was the problem is our God hasn't been delighted in and loved back like He should be. That's the problem with it. So this starts to work on our concept of ourselves and where we are after a while, and then about our lives. And then, let's complete the list a little bit here. And of course, death enters human experience. What is death by definition now? Not simply physical death, but when the temptation that we talked about was occurring and the evil one said, you won't die. You surely won't. Did the man and the woman physically die the moment they sinned? All right. So the devil could have argued, see, I told you, you're still here. But what Gene just said is death is by definition separation. And spiritual death is, but you said separation from God, right? How do you know that they were spiritually dead? All right, their eyes were open, but I said it a while ago, here comes the voice of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. That's a wonderful picture. I wish I could know what that meant. How does the voice of God go walking in the garden? And what did they do? They were afraid and they hid. Why? They were separated, and they knew they were separated. It was guilt, right? The conscience was working on them. So they hid. They were separated from God. So then time went along. They're closed out of the garden. They have a boy a little boy, then they had another little boy, and what happened? One of them killed the other one. And the awful fact of separation, where even their two boys are separated from each other, like Gene said, and then the awful reality of death sets in. And then after that, it'll say, Adam begat Seth, and he lived so many years, and he died. You know, that'll be the way people's lives are described. So death becomes a reality there, and then man finds himself in bondage to what? All right, to fear of death. How in the world can we be in bondage to the fear of death? This may not strike us the way it would have everybody maybe in the first century Roman world, because we always think we can go get treatment and, hey, we're going to live forever. You know, I think everybody's going to pass away but me. And I think most of us are like that. Until they walk in and say, I'm sorry. There's nothing else we can do. And then we realize what this means. What are some of the ways in which bondage to the fear of death impacts us in our lives? Can you think of any way that impacts you? All right. For just danger, right? That's one of the things, and we think about growing older, we think about getting sick, we think about those types of things. It's impossible for you sitting here right now to understand exactly what I'm talking about, because you've heard of the resurrection of Jesus and of hope. But suppose you hadn't had. You can't even suppose that, maybe, but that would be in bondage. We'd be willing to make any compromise to not have to die. We'd always be feeling anxious over that problem. People could threaten us, or people could dominate us in that way, and so forth. And that would be the problem. Now I have a. Let me see which one I've missed here. I probably have missed one of them. One thing that I wanted to point out to us is who holds us? We never would think that we're slaves to anything. Whose slave really are we when we're in bondage to the fear of death? All right, Satan. Why are we Satan's slave when we're in bondage to fear of death? All right, he wants us to be in that position, but it says that he has the power of death. Verse 14, end of the verse. I thought God had the power of death and life. How does Satan have the power of death? How does the devil have the power of death? All right, when you're too scared to live, you're too scared to serve, and you're willing to listen to any kind of a false promise, maybe that would be part of it. But if the wages of sin is death, and if he tempts us and causes us to sin, he's the one who brings the suffering and stuff into life. He's the one then who brings about death. If the power of death is the law, and if the sting of death is sin, then the one who causes us to sin holds the power of death. This is in 1 John 3 and verse 8 and following as well. Certainly in 1 Corinthians 15, toward the end of that chapter, you could see that idea. Two other things I need to mention. One of them is, We are blood and flesh. And I didn't realize until getting to really start working on this class that this is the actual word order in the original, in verse 14, where it talks about since the children share. Nearly all the English translations reverse the word order from the original, which is blood and flesh, and they say it flesh and blood. I think it means basically that we have our mortal limitations, that we have our own weaknesses. I think Psalm 144 and verses 3 and 4 says that. But God be thanked that this is not the end of the story. We also have the ability, the possibility in our life to be potential sons and daughters of God. Go back to chapter 2 and verse 8 again. There is a crucial little word that's in that last sentence. We'll see if you pick it up. In what I'm about to read, there is one word that makes all the difference. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to Him. What's the crucial word there? But now we do not yet see all things subjected to Him. Yet! What does that mean? Yet! Everything will be. So that has to mean that God hasn't been defeated yet. Right? He still has a purpose, or he still is at work at something which He is doing, which is going to put things back like He meant for it to be. That eventually things will be. Now we're going to learn this happens first representatively in His Son, who suffers, is tempted and suffers, and does what to the one who has the power of death? He's resurrected, takes the power of death, takes the keys, and then lets loose the slaves, sets us free. So there is a view of the human condition that's realistic, but exceedingly hopeful. Thank the Lord for that. Let me lead us in prayer before we go. Father, thank You for the hope You have given us in Christ and for the purpose You have worked. Help us to understand ourselves as You see us and to think of ourselves as You say we are. Help us to hope in Christ. Thank You for these dear brothers and sisters. Please be with each of them and their families the rest of this week. In Jesus' name, amen. Same passage Sunday, different viewpoint. So be with us if you're in that class Sunday. Thank you.